This is
Tomorrow's World. Life's big questions answered.
Okay, guys, I don't know what is real anymore.
This has been a long series and we have been taking some twists and turns. And today we're going to be exploring whether or not we're even on a fleshy planet. Are we just ones and zeros? Is it possible that we are living in a simulation?
People might be thinking, this is totally a crackpot show already. What are we talking about?
They've gone mad. Well, you may need to bear with us on this one, but there are real scientists and philosophers grappling with the idea that we might actually quite convincingly be in a simulated reality.
This is like a complete foundational change in what we think the nature of our world is and its origin. My guess is that if the simulators didn't want us to find out, then they probably could prevent us. So I'm Nick Bostrom. I'm a professor at Oxford University, where I direct the Future of Humanity Institute.
They are a group of mathematicians and computational scientists and philosophers that are working together.
They're trying to think carefully about big picture questions for the future of human civilization.
So they have a hypothesis. It's called the simulation hypothesis.
The simulation hypothesis is this proposition that we are living in a computer simulation.
We are living in an advanced computer simulation. Like, really living in a simulation.
We are the simulation.
Everything. From the moment we're born, from, you know, 4.6 billion years ago when Earth and life on it popped up in very simple forms, all of this is just running in a simulation.
Built by some advanced civilization.
Okay, that seems mental.
Yeah, it does.
Okay, I'm going to just go with you on this one.
Mathematics. Probability tells us that there's probably a lot of other civilizations out there. The universe is so huge, so vast and expanding. How could we be the only life form out there? I mean, really.
Even if just a small fraction of civilizations at our stage get through to technological maturity, say 1 in 100. And let's say if even 1 in 100 of those is interested in dedicating some non-trivial portion of their resources for this purpose, then that small set of civilizations that actually engage in this could each create billions or trillions of these ancestor simulations. So it would then be the case that most people with our types of experiences would be in one of these simulations as opposed to in the original history. And if that were the case, it seems that we should believe we are probably one of the simulated ones rather than one of the exceptional non-simulated ones, given that from the inside you can't tell the difference.
Sorry, I know. Just leaves me a bit speechless, so I know that's not very good for podcast medium. Just me sort of blankly staring back at you.
Again, warranted. Like, so they do this kind of stuff with their philosophers and mathematicians and computational modelers.
Now, why would one spend any time thinking about that hypothesis? Well, because there is this argument, the simulation argument, which doesn't show that this simulation hypothesis is true, but it shows that one of three propositions is true, one of which is the simulation hypothesis, so that there are two alternative possibilities as well.
So I want you to just have a really open, generous mind for a few moments and take in these three options. You have to pick one of them as being what you think is real. And if you don't accept any of them, you have to come up with an alternative, and good luck doing that.
Okay.
Okay.
I accept the challenge.
So one of these is going to be the simulation. The other two are going to show you how we must not be living in a simulation.
Okay.
One of them's got to make sense. So Nick Bostrom says that the first one is that all advanced civilizations
lose interest in creating these kinds of computer simulations, ancestor simulations, simulations of their people in their past. They just all decide that's not what we're going to use our computational resources for.
All the advanced civilizations that exist in the universe have a strong convergence amongst them that just says, you know what? We don't want to do this. We're just tired. Maybe we can, but we have no interest, so they don't act on that ability by choice.
Okay, cool.
I mean,
I don't buy that one.
No,
instantly.
I know. If you could do it, why wouldn't you do it? The second reason why we might not be in a simulation.
Uniform doom. There is this strong convergence among all civilizations at our current technological stage of development that they all fail to become technologically mature. They go extinct before reaching technological maturity.
Okay, so there's some sort of universal event that happens when civilizations get to a certain point that will stop them getting so advanced that they would be able to make such a complex simulation.
Exactly. They don't mature. They don't reach their peak potential.
Right. So that could be something like a massive bomb.
Here we're asking for an event that could plausibly be such, not just that it kills one civilization, but it could be sort of uniformly deadly.
Then the third option is the craziest one, and it's, you know, the hardest to accept when you first hear it.
The world we see around us is a computer simulation, that we ourselves are computer simulations, that our brains are simulated. And so this is the simulation hypothesis. So the simulation argument has this surprising conclusion that one of these three disjuncts is true, although it doesn't tell us which one.
Sorry, I'm just standing still staring at you.
Yeah, it's totally bananas. But when we look at these three together, we are forced to accept that it's got to be one of the three.
Well, he's forcing us to accept that.
But logically,
I'm still gonna search for that fourth option.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, don't shut down yet. We're just getting our minds blown in the first few minutes. But what might be a fourth option, do you think?
I'll be honest, nothing's leaping to mind. I'm just uncomfortable, okay?
That is totally legit.
Yeah. I don't know.
So each of these three possibilities are somewhat counterintuitive and surprising if it were true. So on the first one, the idea that all this interest, but that, like, think of just humans, anything we can do in that vein, we do.
Why might a civilization simulate? Well, we can look to our own civilization now, why we do any of the things that we do, like watch films, make them, theater pieces, computer games.
Yeah, and it's not just art. We do it for scientific exploration as well. There are so many motivations behind why we model things, why we simulate things, why we fantasize about things.
Big time.
Virtual reality is real-time 3D graphics moving in such a way that there's no lag perceptible whatsoever. Put the headset on and you're fully immersed. You can look around at 360 degrees and there's something going on everywhere you look. I'm Tony Parisi, Global Head of VR and AR Strategy at Unity Technologies, a 3D technology platform company headquartered in San Francisco, California. So for me, virtual reality, and I've been working in the field for quite some time now, has always been about the ability to create a world, some place that you can go to and have a different kind of experience than you could from the physical world. It could be modeled on the physical world. It could be based on real stuff. But with a technology like this, you can be taken somewhere else without having to go there physically. So that could be, you know, a real place that you can't travel to, and maybe you can't even physically get to because it's remote and inaccessible. Or it could be a completely artificial creation of someone's imagining.
I went to see Dream Reality Interactive to see if they would let me try on some virtual reality headsets.
Hi, Ellie, nice to meet you. I was going to show you a couple of VR demos.
They create games for virtual reality.
Fun.
Yes. And this is my first time using a VR headset, so I am really excited.
So, yeah, this is now called
Sorry.
Deadpool.
Whoa, you're going to get your mind blown, though. You haven't ever tried on a VR headset.
No, I have no idea what's waiting for me.
Okay, I can't wait to hear this.
So, yeah, look around.
We have Wu there, who's helping me navigate it.
Oh, my God. This is weird.
above me, below me, to the side, this crazy other world. It is like a floating island.
In this desert.
In a desert.
On a platform. Yeah,
so I see that there is a bridge in front of me. So I try and work out how to get there. And all I have to do is move my head in the right direction, and suddenly I start moving.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Oh, my
so
God.
Just look at somewhere the ball just goes there.
Oh, my gosh. I feel really sick already.
You started feeling sick?
Woozy.
You don't have to move your whole body.
Am I moving my whole body?
What I was trying to do in this virtual reality was move this crystal ball through this maze that was floating in a desert, and as I went up and down ramps around corners,
when that was going left to right, it felt like the chair I'm sitting on was going left to right.
Like I was on this gentle roller coaster going through this virtual world.
This is
if
so
you want
cool.
The track, you can go
there.
And oh it was really fun. So
it's unfolding in front of me.
Yeah.
Ah, ooh, something's happening up there. Oh my God. So this whole other level and planet has mm-hmm. appeared, and this other world is sort of twisted and revealed this other world in front of me. Let's go explore.
I'm mostly excited about VR as a storytelling medium. We've been doing this for millennia, telling each other stories, and this kind of technology where you have high production value and you're immersed in the experience all around you, the potential just seems so obvious to me. I'm starting to think that virtual worlds, these artificially created worlds that were conceived in the mind of a director like a Brett Leonard or someone like that, a famous movie director is now doing a lot of virtual world development, and they craft a world, but that world is just a jumping off point. It's a place where we all go and then have experiences together. So I think the circumstances are coming together now where we can actually do that in a mind-blowing way, because now we have this consumer technology of VR that's going to make it just super rich and super immersive and a place you can hang out in for a long time.
There's two parts of the brain. There's one that knows you're in that simulation, and there is the subconscious that doesn't.
I meet Dave Ranyard. He is the CEO of Dream Reality Interactive.
In the same way that when film first started and people were in this cinema and there's a train coming towards them, they all go, oh, my God, the train's going to hit us. But if you go into VR and you're over a cliff edge, a bit like when you were playing the game with the crystal, your biology is saying, you've got to be careful, you could die. And so you've actually got a much bigger toolbox as a creative to trigger those emotions. And I think that's also true, not just of the obvious ones like fear or vertigo or something like that, but it's also true of things like emotional ones. So when we've had a character look you in the eye, that's much more powerful when you're in VR than when you're looking at a 2D screen. Because
you're there. With them.
Yeah. And so the step change is about that first hand opportunity of getting those emotions and those biological reactions. That's why it's really exciting. So moving the chair away, don't sit down.
This next simulation was making use of what they call volumetric capture.
Is this an animation or is this recorded with like 3D?
It's like a recorded
3D video recorded image of a real person.
But you see it in your VR headset.
Exactly. So I go and meet him.
Oh, wow. I want to walk up to him.
Yeah, go for it. You've got that.
You'll
feel your legs
away. He walks away. He's looking at me now. This is really weird.
You know, we were talking about Uncanny Valley.
Yeah.
So when you're simulating something human, you never get it quite right. Mm-hmm. And the closer you get to it, but not getting it quite right, the more we feel weird about it and the more we distrust it. This will enable us to get it exactly right.
So there's no sense of being disturbed.
Exactly.
A very 3D rendering of an actual human person. Yes. And he looks... I can even see, like, the shine on his forehead.
Yeah.
And every bit of his facial muscles.
Did it feel exactly like meeting someone in the world without a VR headset on?
It enabled me to have a real experience of what it would be like to meet him in the flesh.
Like he's having all of his emotional
nervousness.
Imagine if he was a famous person. Imagine if he was a superstar that I had been always wanting to meet, that we could bring to life in this virtual reality. I would physically be able to meet with them and interact with them in this simulation.
What if they were someone you wanted to hook up with? My mind quickly goes to the pornography addicted world that we live in.
Right.
And how this is going to be creating new modes of sexual experience for people too.
Definitely. I can see all sorts of fetishes playing out in this virtual world.
Oh yeah.
I've never been right about this stuff in the past, but let me give you my latest thinking on where we're going with everything with immersive technology. First, in terms of how it's going to manifest, I think either through devices, neural implants, or contact lenses, or some everyday technology that just connects the computer to us more intimately visually. So I think it will manifest that way. In terms of how pervasive it's going to be,
ignition sequence starts.
We're going to be getting educated using this technology. Kids are just going to learn by seeing virtual holograms. Whether it's a human cell, a combustion engine, a historical site, those things will be 3D and holographic and all around us and easily accessible in some future version of Wikipedia.
That's one small step for man.
I think we're going to be using that in 1,000 years for sure to, you know, navigate the stars. And that's just fascinating, and that's going to have a permanent part in our media, in the landscape of our media, how we consume entertainment, how we tell stories to each other. So it's here to stay. The hardware is going to evolve over the next several years. It's still fairly crude, fairly early edition consumer hardware. But as we go forward, those systems are going to get lighter, cheaper. They're going to be incorporated more and more into our daily lives, and it's here to stay.
So, Britt, are you tending to agree with one of those three arguments that Nick Bostrom laid out?
Let's just revisit what they are. So, the first option, according to the simulation hypothesis, is that we or some other advanced civilization, we're just going to lose interest before we get there. For some reason, we're going to decide not to do it. We're going to hold back.
Not bothered.
Yeah, it's going to be an intimate technology that we're using every day, and it will manifest as VR and AR and all these other R's, and will be connected in with all the use cases we can imagine for computers and ones that, you know, we haven't thought of and will exist long after we've shuffled off.
We're far too curious to lose interest in something this amazing.
We are far too curious, and then all the other civilizations that might be out there, any advanced civilization, one of them's got to be curious enough to try and do this.
Then you think, well, so maybe it's not that. Maybe it's the second one. We are bound to go extinct before becoming technologically mature. Well, maybe it's not so improbable that, like, the human civilization, maybe we destroy ourselves. But it would have to be a very uniform fate for virtually all intelligent civilizations throughout the universe at our stage of development. They would all, not just 99%, but 99.999 with a fairly large number of nines, would all have to fail to reach this technological mature conditions.
Nick Bostrom talks about this in terms of different colored marbles.
So I think of sometimes this process of scientific research as the process of extracting balls from a big urn. These are ideas that we bring into the world, and we have extracted a great many. All around the urn lie scattered these balls, and they have been on balance hugely beneficial. This is what has created the modern human condition. So most balls have been sort of white balls.
Ah, insulin.
That's a good one. That's a white marble. Cool. Reaching in, prosthetic limbs.
White. Every time we make a new scientific discovery, it's like us reaching into the urn and picking out a marble. The jet engine.
Is that white?
Yeah.
Then you might reach in and pick out one that's red. It could be a synthetic virus.
Right. Pandemic. It could be a nuclear weapon.
So both those things would devastate probably millions of people, but not everything.
If you are worried about something like a nuclear war, it seems hard to think of that as the kind of disaster that would befall virtually all advanced civilizations. You would expect there would be variations in culture, in politics, in world governance, and other things that would make not everybody behave exactly the same way with regard to nukes.
Now, what if one of those marbles is a black marble?
Well, we haven't pulled out yet a black ball. We haven't discovered some idea that invariably destroys the civilization that discovers it.
Okay, we can try to describe what a black marble that would destroy everything is.
It has to be so innocuous that no advanced civilization would ever be able to prepare for it. It would have to be something that you couldn't predict would happen, because otherwise there would be an advanced civilization that would be able to make a plan to make sure that that wasn't completely obliterating. So what about, try this one on for size.
Mm-hmm.
What about if we invented something like the microwave,
mm-hmm.
kind of an inevitable white marble that we think, you know, cool. But when you put sand in it and switch it on,
you might more plausibly be looking perhaps at some technological discovery that is almost invariably made once you advance sufficiently in science and technology, that then makes it perhaps too easy to destroy the world. So if we discovered some technology whereby you could, a single person, through 5 minutes of work on their own, could destroy the entire world, then at that point it looks like we would go extinct.
If there are any black balls in this whole pot, eventually we're going to pick it out. Because yeah. we're just keeping digging in there.
Exactly.
So if there is a black ball in there, we don't know there's definitely a black ball in there, but if there is, we will find it.
We'll get there.
And if we find it before we can make simulations, we'll never be able to make simulations.
That's like really bad news. If almost all civilizations at our stage go extinct before technological maturity, then probably we will go extinct. So that's bad news. Now, on the other hand, this doesn't say anything about the timeline here. So it's consistent with us sort of surviving for a long time before going extinct, provided during all of that time we have not yet really catapulted ourselves into this more technologically advanced level. As it happens, to me, it looks like we're really not that far away from, say, developing machine superintelligence. I mean, by not that very far, you could argue about whether it's like a few decades or a few hundred, but it's like weird to think that it would take many millennia.
Some people say, what, by the 2040s?
Yeah.
That has been stated as the mean expectation by machine learning experts in the survey that Nick Bostrom conducted himself. Then that's really bad news.
Once you have machine superintelligence, then I think you have a telescoping of the future in that it could then invent all these other technologies at digital timescales rather than slow human biological timescales.
At the moment, we're quite cumbersomely getting up out of our chair, stretching our back, craning our hand into the urn, picking something out. An artificial superintelligent is nailing that.
Totally.
If you combine the hypothesis that there is this uniform doom with the hypothesis that we are actually not that far from developing these advanced technologies that would lead to technological maturity, then that seems quite pessimistic, that combination, in that then we are, conditional on that, faced with sort of fairly imminent doom.
For me, that's not that surprising. I think I inherently assume that we will go extinct. I think I've always sort of felt that. Is that weird?
Me too. I think that's very common for our generation, you know? I think we've been told that the world will end since we were born. But it also just seemed like looking around at the power of these technologies and how quickly we understand that they're changing, it's hard to think otherwise.
That seems quite pessimistic. So you might hope that one of the other disjuncts is true instead.
That we're in a simulation.
Well, that's one of them. And the other is the convergence into sort of losing interest in creating ancestor simulations. So that you just decide not to do that.
No, I think we scrapped that one a while ago, didn't we?
Yeah, we're far too curious to lose interest in something this amazing.
And then the third possibility, that we are in a computer simulation. That's very puzzling as well. That seems almost crazy at first sight, right? That the whole world we see around us is literally a simulation inside a computer built by some other civilization. But nevertheless, the simulation argument seems to force us to accept that at least one is true.
We spend about 11% of our conscious time in a dream, and we don't question that, which feel to us at the time completely real. If our own minds can fool us, right, then surely a powerful simulation built by someone would fool us even better. Who knows? The problem with this whole example is that it can quickly descend into ridiculousness, because there's no real way of knowing, right? Whether it's all, I mean, people have wondered for thousands of years whether how they could know what was real, right? With various inconclusive answers.
This is Herman Narula. He's the CEO of Improbable.
An Improbable CEO.
Yes.
The idea behind Improbable is to build the underlying technology that will let us build massive participatory virtual worlds.
Herman is the most excitable, fast-talking, imaginative, incredibly intelligent person that I've met for quite a long time.
There's a running joke that we've actually already succeeded, and this entire exercise is just, the world as we know it is just a simulation in our lobby in our future office where we kind of remember what it was like. So, you know, who knows?
That's quite.
Do you know what I mean? That kind of glittery excitement.
Yeah. He must be pumped to think about what he's building.
So it's about enabling, you know, hundreds of thousands, maybe one day millions of people to inhabit massive virtual worlds that can enrich people's lives and help us solve problems. We build a distributed operating system called Spatial OS that runs in the cloud. So companies and developers can use our technology to build these types of virtual worlds.
They make the platform, people add the rest.
Yeah.
Now, typically in the way games work today, there are lots of people that play the same game, but they tend to play them in small, separate, siloed copies, which can only contain a few people at a time. That means that a lot of the world is really limited and restricted. In particular, you can't have interesting systems that create enriching experiences like physics or, you know, complex ecologies or persistence. All of those qualities require more computing power than anyone can currently bring to bear.
So while we think we're all interacting in this same virtual world, actually there are like lots and lots of clones of those worlds.
Exactly. It's kind of like the way when you go to a theater, a really great production with an amazing set can make you feel like for a moment that the characters are actually in, you know, in Saigon or whatever, right? But really, they're just on the same stage and the sets just get changed out, right? I mean, they're not actually in a place, right? So in games, there's almost a bubble of reality around the player as you move around the world. But when you're not there, nothing happens. The world doesn't exist. If we're able to bring to bear all the computing power, which is now cheaply at our disposal, to solve these problems, we can build much more enriching worlds.
What Spatial OS does is uses tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of computer cores situated all around the world to create one giant supercomputer.
We need to manage the computation of a virtual world over many, many different machines, all of which are separated by network connections and all of which can fail. And that creates just thousands of technical challenges which haven't needed to be addressed before. It's like a giant game of musical chairs with no conductor. The whole thing is distributed, right? So it's like a symphony, but no one's in charge. And the whole thing is executing to manage this virtual world, a single large shared world.
They're only a few years old.
One of the very first games being built on our technology was called Worlds Adrift. And it's a small initial game, it's an independent game, but already it's a world, a single world, the size of Wales, with far more people than could normally fit onto a single world. And it has physics and it has all sorts of strange drama happening inside that world.
So this is Worlds Adrift, which is a game being produced by Bossa Studios. They're a London-based game studio that we've been working with for a while. This is built on Spatial OS.
So essentially, do you have a jigsaw of worlds hosted on different servers?
Different server cores. We have a single seamless world hosted across multiple cores. And for the user, they don't experience any transition between areas managed by different cores. The whole world is about 1,000 square kilometres. But we can make that world can be made larger. You just sort of you increase the number of cores it's running on.
Right.
But right now, the number of people playing in this closed beta means that having a 1,000-kilometer-square world gives you the right balance of sort of meeting people and interacting with them, and also being able to feel like you're, you know, a pioneer. You can see those islands off in the distance there.
So what I can see is these essentially lumps of floating rock, which are surrounded by clouds, and each of these floating islands are actual inhabited places.
Every one of those is a spatial entity. That's not background. You could move directly. You could steer, assuming we have a steering wheel on this ship. Oh, there we go. you could steer towards one of those islands.
So you're on this, what looks like a spaceship, made out of wood with propellers. Maybe it's a mixture between an island and an aeroplane. And you're leaping onto different islands. I've just seen you chop down a tree. I assume that that was for some reason, not just the joy of deforestation.
That's to help us build more components for the ship. So the ship is completely bespoke. You can change the shape of it, you can change the structure, you can change the materials it's made out of. You build the engines, you build the sails. Everything about it is custom made, but you need materials to make it. So like Minecraft or games like that, where you harvest the world for resources, that's what I was doing. I was just finding bits because I recognised the bits of the ship were broken, so I was just trying to find something to repair it.
You'd land on the island would be full of entities like those artificially intelligent manta rays down there. They're part of an ecosystem, which again is totally modelled. So if you turn on your engines and the manta rays are close enough to hear, they get irritable. And ultimately, if they get too irritable, they attack your ship. Attacking your ship can break bits off it, because the ship itself is made of lots and lots of physics-controlled entities, you know, individual panels, engines. And then bits of the ship can fall to the ground on the island, if you're above an island, and they'll then kind of be eaten by local wildlife, who are then predated on by the manta rays, and the whole thing sort of acts as a complete ecosystem. And again, that's artificial intelligence.
By that, do you mean that they can learn and have opinions?
They're animals, so they're reasonably simple. If you make noise, as you can see there, they head towards the noise. If they're aggravated by the noise, they try to destroy it by headbutting it, effectively, by attacking it.
Are they likely to get behaviours, to learn behaviours that you haven't pre-programmed?
That's a really interesting question. I think probably at this level, their behaviour is reasonably predictable. But certainly what we can find is that if there are very large numbers of entities, in this case, you know, animals in the world, interacting simultaneously, then what you do get is emergent behaviours. So a very large number of manta rays and other animals interacting in the space will behave in ways that you couldn't necessarily accurately predict if you have a model with one or two of them, for example. And then the player, of whom there are thousands potentially in the world at the same time, interacts with those entities, with each other. People build ships together and research new technologies to improve their ships and explore between these worlds.
Are there any rules, or will we have any government in this world?
The idea is that people should be free to essentially to do what they want. So one person could, for example, accumulate a lot of a particular rare kind of wood or metal and start trading it inside the game. Somebody else might want to build the biggest and most impressive ship. There are objectives. For example, different areas of the world are divided by wind walls. And to get through a wind wall, which is an area where there are very high winds, because everything has physics. So if you go into that wind wall, you'll be buffeted. And, you know, if you have sails, they might break off. At the moment, people are mapping the world. So they're exploring using the ships and drawing maps of the world to help other people.
This initial work that we've done and the initial beta that we've built is already being used to make games, but we're continually improving it and making it larger and larger in scale, being able to cope with more and more complexity. And eventually we'll reach the point where we can hit walls that are so big, you know, our like secret internal, we've never stated it publicly, goal, but you know, 15, 20 years from now would be to make it so that 1 billion people could exist in a single virtual world.
Whoa. You heard it first in Tomorrow's World.
Exclusive scoop there.
They want to create worlds that could fit 1 billion people in them.
Things at that scale have never, ever been attempted in terms of a virtual world.
This is very much like an embryonic Ready Player One virtual world. I mean, thinking about all the different aspects of society that can just be recreated in the virtual world they're building.
So a premise behind the simulation argument is this claim that a technologically mature civilization would be capable of creating these types of simulated worlds, with simulated brains in them, simulated at a level of detail such that these simulations would be conscious and indeed have experiences indistinguishable from the experiences that we have. One can say some things to make that premise possible. we can estimate the computational performance of systems we can't currently build.
Cool. This is not based on our current computational technology. It's based on what we know through the laws of physics that would be physically possible to run.
Yeah.
And once we get to a level of advancement that we're able to manipulate all physical matter to an incredible degree, then we will be able to just knock out these simulations before T.
Like, if you build a computer using molecular nanotechnology and you scaled it up to the size of a planet, let us say, how many computational operations per second would such a system be able to perform? We can estimate that on the one hand, and then we can also estimate the computational power of the human brain. And it turns out that there is a great many orders of magnitude difference between these two, so that even using a very conservative estimate of what a technologically mature civilization could do with its computational engineering, it's still the case that by using just, say, one planet worth of compute for just 1 minute, they could run trillions of simulations of all of human history, all the humans that have ever lived.
1 minute, trillions of civilizations simulated.
He's so casual about this.
Yeah, very.
So will it always be people in our world playing in the virtual world? Or could we potentially start to see people making artificial intelligence in that world to support them?
So I think that's a really great question. You know, AI, likely the first place that we will really get to know AI will be in virtual worlds, because it's the first level playing field between people and human-like AIs. But within a virtual world, you know, we're in an environment which the AI and us can see and interact with and understand in largely the same way. And we're in an environment where, you know, both of us are agents in this environment, likely trying to accomplish something. So it might be the first place where we have that interaction with AI. I mean, the alternative is for the AI to inhabit some sort of, you know, robotic entity in the real world, but that involves solving loads of other technical challenges. So presumably virtual worlds are like a great first place to do that.
Yeah, the mind-boggling thing about what he just said was that when we create artificial intelligence, a logical first place to put them would be in a simulated world. Now, if that is true, and if that ends up being possible, then we get to our point three. We get to that third argument that it is possible to create a simulated world with intelligence in it. And that makes us potentially the artificial intelligence in a simulated world. That suggests that if this is possible, then we are, in fact, living in a simulated reality. And that is when I go and say, can we stop recording because I need to puke?
I know, I'm getting, like, tingly spine sensations, and we're just fulfilling the role too aptly. That description, it matches exactly how we're living right now in building AI.
It gives a reason why you would want to do a simulation. And we know that it's probably possible because we know we can do AI and we know we can do simulation. We're getting pretty close to that third thing, that third argument.
If we develop over time, over the next several decades, when we develop to the point where we are able to create our own ancestor simulations, and we're still interested in doing that, and we are about to switch on our own simulation of people exactly like our historical forebears, at that point we would have to sort of basically eliminate the first two hypotheses. Like, if we made it through, then it's not the case that virtually all civilizations at our stage failed to make it through. If we still are interested, that's strong evidence that it's not the case that virtually no technologically mature civilization is interested, so that we then leave only the third disjunct, that we're in a simulation. So if we made those observations, that we're sort of on the path to being able to create our own ancestor simulations, that would increase the probability.
I'm just thinking, it's just really weird. Yeah. I just shrug my shoulders in terms of the importance of that to the way that I feel about being alive. I feel just as alive if I think that we're simulated versus if I don't think that we're simulated.
Right, because everything we know about the universe is still true. it still behaves in the way that we've found out that it behaves. I still had my most important relationship and friendships.
Yeah, definitely. All the meaning that I've ever been able to collect in my life still stands.
As well as it did before I knew that it was possible that we'd be in a simulation.
Totally.
I mean, what even is anything anyway?
It might, in some sense, be less crazy in that if this argument is correct, it's like a simpler overall worldview that fits the pieces together. But it's certainly the sort of physics worldview we've had more time maybe to get accustomed to. There's probably a lot of just inertia behind this, like we are shocked by the things that are novel, but a lot of everyday occurrences, if you were an angel descended to Earth and this was your first day of earthly life, that would probably be a lot of things that would be totally bizarre and shocking and outrageous that we take for granted.
If we say that it's silly that we believe that we're just in a simulation, then we have to accept that reality is what physics says we are.
Which is pretty crazy in itself.
Right.
So 13.8 billion years ago, give or take a little bit of time, there was a huge bang. There was a super high energy density period, which then created a bunch of hydrogen.
The hydrogen condensed to form the first stars.
The stars exploded, forming the rest of the elements.
The dust from those stars floated through space, congealing to form new stars, new planets, and new solar systems.
And one of those solar systems in an inconsequential corner of the universe known as the Milky Way.
A little planet called Earth started to get wet.
Wet?
Yeah. Let's move forward quickly.
And in that wetness, a myriad of chemical reactions started to take place, one of which was the kind of reaction that could recreate its components again and again.
And it did this again and again for 4 billion years, creating all the life and all the complexity that we now know on Earth.
And all of that activity led to this very moment where we can be sitting here
and somehow managing to have a vaguely coherent conversation.
Or we could be simulated and somehow have been directed to evolve into such a form at a certain time so that we would believe that something like that is true in terms of the physics of the universe.
Well, that's crazy, clearly.
Clearly. Clouds, somewhere far away, all that's left of this place, are these broken remains, wait for the dust to settle. We came crashing down, so many stories buried underground, waiting to be found. We'll take to the sky, and I will find your memory somehow.
The truth is that this is the end for now, and we're in denial about that. It has been an absolute ride with you guys. Thank you so much for being here with us.
And for being brave enough to consider some of these things we've explored together as plausible, as true, or as total crazy science fiction. All of it matters. All of it are things we should be thinking about. We've been obliterated by AI.
Down to the molecular level, checking out some DNA.
We've been trying on our wizard hat.
Oh, yeah. That was ages ago.
That was ages ago.
It's been quite a ride.
Hopefully we've helped you increase your bandwidth for ambivalence when thinking about these possibilities.
Yeah.
Take to the sky. That's a wrap for this show.
With me, Ellie Cosgrave.
And me, Britt Ray, on the BBC Tomorrow's World podcast. We've got to thank everyone involved in making this program.
Producer Dave Dodd, Olivia Humphreys, Anishka Sharma, Kevin Dawson, and musician Andy Gillam.
This has been a Whistledown production for the BBC.
We use lots of sounds for this episode from freesound.org. If you want to see a list of those sounds, as well as much more information about the different episodes, go to bbc.co.uk/tomorrowsworld.
You can also, of course, find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
And you can join the conversation at #MyTomorrow.
Unpredictable.
Hey, how can you be a drag queen and not sing live?
Unprovoked.
Monstrosity.
Unapologetic.
It's almost like she set fire to the celebrity feudal system.
Unperturbed.
I want to do that.
Uncompromising.
Big foam batons.
Unrepentant.
This is it!
Welcome to Unpopped, the podcast that digs deep into pop culture. Search for us and subscribe via your usual podcast thing.
I'm such a beautiful woman, Patrick Swayze.